Govinda Deshikam Upasya Siraya Vaktyam Tasmin Sthite Nijamatmi Videhuktyam Advaitya Vashyam Upakalpa Diso Vijityam Kanchi Puresitam Avapata Shankaraya Puranaanam Alayam Karunalayam Namami Bhagatvada Shankaram Bhoga Shankaram Apara Karuna Sindhum Jnanatam Shantarupinam Sri Chandrasekhara Gurum Namami Ramyam.
With benediction to Adi Shankaracharya and to his lineage up to the 69th and the 70th Gurus of the venerated Kamakoti Peetham, I rise to address you today. It gives me great pleasure to associate myself with this pleasant and solemn function organized this evening to commemorate the 117th birth anniversary of Pujya Sri Chandrasekharendra Saraswati Swamigal, the 68th Acharya of this venerated Peetham. The Shankaran Netralaya has always associated itself with the sage of Kanchi and all the causes that were dear to him. Unfailingly, it has celebrated the advent of the sage onto this earth each year. An occasion like this is one of joy, mirth and glee, of nostalgia down the memory lane as to how an ordinary boy from an obscure village was converted into a saint extraordinary who tread this earth for 100 long years and ever remained a beacon of light. Like the lighthouse that beats no drum and sounds no gong, and yet to the mariner in the distant sea experiences the friendly light, so too was the sage of Kanchi who radiated his blessings all around. During the 87 years of his pontificate of the Kamakoti Peetham, the Peetham reached dizzy heights of spiritual supremacy. In its own unobtrusive way, the Kamakoti Peetham symbolizes the true spirit of Hinduism, non-dietatic, philosophical and tolerant. With his aura, credibility and authority, the sage remained the center stage of the cultural and the religious renaissance of this country during the 20th century. This master of masters was like an ambient light who rekindled the spirit of the nation and brought forth a renaissance in many fields of religion, thought and practice. He taught mankind groping in the dark as to how to journey to a higher destiny despite all these sights in science and technology. He was the voice of eternal India. He attained his Videhimukti on the 8th of January 1984. Such was the power of his presence that not only a few of his devotees who filed past his mortal retreats, people from all walks of life, from all shades and hues, came to have a last glimpse of the sage before he was departing from this earth. In fact, a namaz was held in the dargah next door and 500 of the faithfuls marched into the mat to pay their obeisance to the Jagadguru. When Dr. Badrinath invited me to come over to speak today, I was a bit diffident. I had come across into this institution several number of times and an equal number of times to celebrate the birth anniversary of the sage of Kanchi. I have spoken enough about the sage, of his life and times and of his contributions and to the cause of Sanatana Dharma for which he lived all through his 100 years. And therefore I was wondering, what is it that I can speak which will be different than the ones that I have spoken from this platform all along? And then he said, for a change, you can be assured that there shall be some of my students over here in the audience. And the moment I heard that there are going to be some young minds over here, I could not resist accepting this invitation. It is one thing to do physical energy and regulate your food, to tone your body and keep yourself fit and remain young. But I think the easiest prescription that one can have to remain young is to remain in the company of the young. And therefore, who could resist the opportunity, the privilege to be amongst few of the youngsters who are going to be over here to share thoughts about the sage of Kanchi and more importantly to draw inspiration from the energy that you all have and the way you shape your careers to meet the challenges of this competitive world. And therefore, I shall certainly speak about the sage of Kanchi because today we are celebrating his 117th birth anniversary. But I shall come to that at the end of the address. I shall speak to you something which he loved, something which he cherished, something which he espoused, something that was dear to him, namely the Hindu religion itself. If I were to tell you that almost all of us, except a few who are veterans in this field, have never understood this religion, because some of the obscure practices that have gone into this religion, which defy the elements of rationality, most of us have been dissuaded from understanding the Hindu philosophy. Hinduism is indeed a way of life. And if today I have chosen to speak to you on life itself, it is essentially those components of life that Hinduism gives to us. And let me preface by saying, all religions in the world are the same. In practices relating to worship of God, or speaking the truth, or even love and hate, all the religions have the same philosophy. It is only in relation to some doctrines which are based on the outcome of the experience of the founders of that religion, or those who perpetuate that religion, or those who practice that religion, and more importantly, those who have taken those religions to greater heights. It is those experiences that get into the gamut of those doctrines that make differences between religions. Otherwise, these religions are one and the same. Unlike other religions who draw their names from the founders themselves, like Jaina from Jainism, Buddha from Buddhism, or Christ from Christianity, this religion of ours has neither a beginning, and there is a great belief that it does not have an end. Anadikalam, from times immemorial, this religion has existed. As long as civilization has been recorded into history, this religion was there. Therefore, there is a belief that anyone who is to any other religion, some of their forefathers at some point of time would have been Hindus. The greatest lesson that we learn from all religions is that we should do our duty and then leave the rest, including our fortunes and future, to God. That's not a symbol of inaction or a disdain. It is a concept of surrender unto the great Lord, that all that we have done, that it is for you now to decide what to give to us. That's why it's called as karma phala data, the one who gives you the reward for all the efforts that you put in. The strength of a religion does not lie in the number of followers of that religion. Certainly not. If that were the great fact, the Christianity would have been the most dominant religion ever in the world, based on the size of the people who follow it. It is those who follow the religion in the truest tenet of that religion and practice it to the fullest extent, they are the people who add strength to that religion. And if the religion outlives generations and goes into several millennia, it is the contribution of these practitioners of the religion that makes a difference. History is replete with facts that each of the religions that are available today have enough of those prophets who have truly followed that religion and taken it forward. And that's no exception to Hinduism also. And in the 20th century, we had two great souls, almost in the same place, very close to each other, Ramana Maharishi and His Holiness Pujya Sri Chandrasekharendra Saraswati Swamigal, who had sustained the cause of Hinduism and taken it forward. The word Hindu has never been given by anybody, because as I told you, its existence, its status has never been known. This was given by the Westerners who came into this country for the first time crossing the river Indus. And the civilization that existed on the banks of the river Indus, they called it as India, and the people who lived in that civilization were called as Indians. There is another school of thought where this word Hindu means abhorrence of violence or love. And that is one of the tenets of this religion, which I shall come to later. And that's why the name, even when the Westerners gave it, it reflected the character of this religion. The biblical story of Adam and Eve, of Eve eating that forbidden fruit and be unhappy, and Adam being not interested in that, and he was unhappy with the fruit being eaten, finds a reference even in the Hindu philosophy. The entire Hindu philosophy originates or stems from the Vedas. From times immemorial, Vedas have come into being. Bhagavan Vedavyasa synthesized them from vibrations and handed down through four of his disciples. This is an unwritten text that has gone down several millennia through the Guru Shishya Parampara. It is one thing to say that the Vedas are eternal and are undiminishing, but the fact of the matter is The original recensions that Bhagavan Vedavyasa gave had 1,311 recensions, and today we hardly have 12 of them. And most of them also have been archived, they have been fossilized, and there is a distinct possibility that the succeeding generations in this world may be denied the privilege and pleasure of understanding the Vedas themselves. Unless serious efforts are being made to preserve, to protect and perpetuate the Vedas, this indeed was the life mission of the sage of Kanchi. When he was asked what was his duty, he said, the only duty for which I am over here is to preserve the Vedas. So as I said, the story of Adam and Eve also was there in the Vedas many, many years before, because Christ came to be only 2,000 and odd years before. And that was the story of a people tree on which was perched two birds. One that was eating a fruit was unhappy, and the other was not eating the fruit and was therefore happy. It is this people tree which is called the tree of wisdom, and it is this underneath this tree Bhagavan Buddha got his wisdom, enlightenment and nirvana. This is also the human body in its simile, and into this body the like of these two birds that have been described got entangled into the human body, the Jivatman and the Paramatman. The Jivatma is entangled into the limbs of the body, and because of the forces of Maya has got its desires and attachments. The Paramatman shines all by itself, unattached to any of these Jnanendriyas and the Karmendriyas, standing alone by itself. The Jiva therefore, since it is attached to the body, is perishable. It decays with time. With efflux of time, it destroys itself. But whereas the Paramatman is eternal and remains, this is the core of Hindu philosophy. The Lord himself says in Bhagavad Gita, describing it to our level of understanding as to what this can be, when he says about the soul, Nainam Chindati Badrani, Nainam Dahati Pavakaha, it's not cleared by even fire, nor can it be drifted away by even wind. And then he goes to explain the concept of the soul by saying, Vasamsi Jirnani Yada Vihaya, Navani Grinnati Naroparani. Just as a person changes his soiled shirt and puts on a new shirt, so too is the soul which moves away from one body which is destroyed or about to be destroyed into another body. This is the broad concept that the Lord gave of Hinduism. The basic stem on which the Hinduism stands is based on the concept of Aham Brahmasmi, which again comes from Vedas, that I am the creator. There is a reference in Brahmasutra Bhashyam which says that the Lord is the creator. Therefore, by induction and logic, if I am the creator and the Lord is the creator, then I am the Lord. Aham Brahmasmi therefore would mean I am God myself. If I were to advance this doctrine that I am God myself to all of you, 99 out of 100 will dismiss the thought by saying either he is mad or he is arrogant and aggressive, that he has arrogated to himself the powers of the Lord. This is the greatness of this religion. Aham Brahmasmi, I am the Lord myself, is the essence of this religion. But then when it is difficult for us to accept a proposition that I am God, because what follows naturally is, then why am I worshipping this, as Swami Vivekananda said, 3.3 million gods that have come over into this country, and quite a few of them which came from Far East to this country, that we are all worshipping. And why is it that I have to go into temples to worship when God is residing in me and I am the God myself? That is why the rishis of the yore had given an advanced and a graduated level of understanding of the concept of Hinduism itself and of this basic thought of Hinduism that I am God myself. And therefore, like life itself in the Hindu philosophy is graduated into four stages: the Brahmacharyam, the Grahastashram, Vanaprastham, and lastly the Sannyasam. And just as you cannot reach the top of the ladder unless you go through the rung of the ladder, so therefore to have a deeper understanding of this Hindu religion itself, the rishis of the yores had given various stages. Prathamam Pratima Puja, Japastotrani Madhyamam, Udyamam Manasika Puja, and lastly comes Aham Brahmasmi. Prathamam Pratima Puja, the first stage in understanding of this religion is idol worship. When an idol is given across to a child, it becomes a toy. It plays along with it. When you graduate in age and maturity, you ensure that the idol is not defiled. you take care of the title. When you come to the stage of Brahmacharyam, when you start understanding life more, you transfer the title into the puja room and start worshipping it. It is the same idol, the same which is conceived as a toy, which is not defiled. It is therefore by impregnating life into that idol that you can experience divinity. And what is the highest form to which you can go here? Acharya Goswami Tulsidas says in Ramacharitramanas, Yayasa Dravam Dravati, by which even that idol God will melt, that is the extent of bhakti that you have, then you have graduated from this stage of understanding the Lord Himself. So that level of bhakti, that level of attachment to the idol when it comes, then you have moved on. The second stage is Japastotrani. This is the Nama Sankirtana component of it, where you use your vocal cord to sing glory of the Lord. And then you start realizing Him. For Thaimanavar, it is said in Tamil, Urugi Urugi Aikyamanar. He went on singing in the glory of the Lord and got himself merged into the Lord Himself. Therefore, this is the stage where several people have gone through this marga and attained salvation, be it Tukaram, Namdev, or Janabai from Maharashtra, or Purandaradasa, or Basavanna from Karnataka, Jayadeva from Andhra Pradesh, or Tirumular, or Jnanasambandar, or Upper, or many more from Tamil Nadu, many more parts of the country, or use the Bhakti Marga. Kalau Bhakti Reva Garyasi. In Kali Yuga, this is the most important, the easiest form of salvation, that you sing in the glory of the God and absorb yourself into this stage. And in Kali Yuga, both the first and the second stage are practiced together. The idol worship along with the Namasankirtanam comes together. Once you have reached the pinnacle of understanding of Lord through the glory of singing in praise of Him, then the external objects do not become of any consequence to you. That idol is non-existent in your mind. You are not able to perceive that there is something before you. Then you start looking inwards. When you start looking inwards, then you realize that there is something in you and not in those idols which are there. The very same idols that you had worshipped, you had prayed for, but today you start seeing them inside you. And that is why the rishis of the yore have withdrawn themselves as recluse, moved away from places of common interest and into the forest and into the mountains, where they start cleansing their mind through a process of meditation. And that is the third stage, when you control your indriyas, all your sensual pleasures, even the habits of eating. That's why you have several of the Jain Munis who have stayed without food and water for several number of days. Medical history has been defied by them. In fact, a few years before, somebody was credited with the world record of 434 days without even a pinch of food, except warm water that was being given to him. It is the process by which you control the senses. Then when you start looking inwards, you start realizing that there is divinity within you. This is the highest stage to which a person can come. And that's the stage that you graduate to, that stage where Aham Brahmasmi will come. That I am the Lord myself. I have to start looking into myself to realize that I am the creator myself. In Ketopanishad, it is said of this stage, Yastis sarvani bhutani atmanneva anupushyati sarvabhuteshu cha atmanam tattona vikupaste. He who sees himself in others and sees others in himself, he does not hate anyone any longer. Because he knows that if there is divinity in him, there is divinity equally in others. The only thing is the extent to which the divinity in others is not even manifest. That the jackals in them have not come forward or the heights in them have not been suppressed. The extent to which the divinity comes forward is based on the conduct of the person himself. But the fact remains that there is divinity in every person. And that is why you reach a stage in life where you know that there is divinity in other person, therefore I don't hate anyone. Everyone is equal. The Samabhava will come at the highest stage of understanding of life itself. And that stage, the stage of Kanchi, reached very early in his life. It is by his inwardness, by cleansing himself. And later I shall speak to you as to how he used, like Mahatma Gandhi, fasting as a medium to cleanse himself, cleanse his thought and cleanse his mind and purity, that he reached this stage in life. So this is the stage up to which you come. In the first stage itself, when you come to the first stage, which is the idol worship, to which all of you belong to, and which we also belong to, it was Adi Shankaracharya, 2,515 years before, formulated the Shanmatastapanam, the Prastapanam, the six schools of worship. He said, it is necessary that these idols are identified. Therefore, you are able to have the idols of your choice, the worship of your choice. Therefore, he brought the six schools of thought, the Shaivam, the Vaishnavam, the Shakti, the Ganpatyam, the Kaumaram, and the Surya. And then, it was Shankara whose philosophy said, you can give n number of names to the deities. That is why Lalita Sahasranamam. And the Namavadi itself is 1,000 names for the Shakti itself, Goddess herself. Therefore, you give any name that you want. This is very unique to Hindu philosophy and Hindu religion, that you can give to the idol any name that you want. The one that is convenient to you to understand the divinity of the idol itself. And therefore, you start experiencing divinity in your own manner, and not in the manner in which it is conditioned by a particular religion. Thisness of this religion, which is non-existent anywhere else. Once have we come to this basic understanding, therefore, the next question that comes to is, where do you look to God then? We look up to the sky most of the time and say, where is the abode of Shiva, where is the abode of Vishnu? Oh, I need you now because I am in distress. And Sant Kabir says, Dukume sabiran sabukare, sukume kare na koi. Sukume sabiran sabukare, to dukku kahan hoi. It is only in times of adversity that you remember God. And when you are in prosperity, you don't remember Him. Just put the cycle the other way around. When you start remembering in times of prosperity, then that adversity will never come to you, sis. And therefore, when you look upwards, there is nothing there. It is all imaginary. Of the abodes of Lord being there up in the heavens, imaginary. And the Lord Himself says, as a proof to where God is, to Narada, He says, Naham Vasami Vaikunte, Yoginam Hrudayenacha, Madbhakta Yatra Gayanti, Tishtami Tatra O Narada. O Narada, I don't stay in Vaikunta, there is no Vaikunta. I don't even stay in the hearts of hermits. Madbhakta Yatra Gayanti, where my devotees celebrate life. Gayanti should not be seen as simply as singing, it is celebration of life. There I remain, says the Lord. Tishtami, there I sit, I am there, He says. And what is the celebration of life? There is a school of thought in English, which is a very interesting concept. He says, sound when stretched is music, body when stretched is dance, mind when stretched is meditation, life when stretched is celebration. When you stretch your life, go beyond the call of your duty, look up to things which are beyond the normal potential in you, that's the time that you will reach the zenith of what you are capable of doing, and that is celebration. And once you celebrate life, the divinity will be present in you. The Lord is described as Ananta Kalyana Guna Sampannaha, one who is endowed with all auspicious qualities. So by corollary and logic, if a person is endowed with all auspicious qualities, the Lord should reside in him. The Shastras themselves are saying, Udyamam Sahasam Dairyam Buddhir Shaktir Parakramaha Shatate Yatra Desyante Devo Pitatra Deshati. When you see these six qualities, Udyamam, Sahasam, Dairyam, Buddhi, intellect, Shakti, strength, Parakramaha, valor, when all these things are there in the person, the Lord stays there. So where do you look for Lord? Where is this God? We look into ourselves. Look into these people who have started looking inward to see that Aham Brahmasmi, I am the Lord myself. And with these people who are endowed with all these qualities, and in them we see God. That brings me to the next concept. If God resides in me, I am God myself, where is the need for me to go to temples? What is special about temples that we are going to temples? This is basically because in the first stage, the idol worship stage into which we are in, we are an imperfect world and we are imperfect persons because we are not graduated to the level of understanding that the rishis and the yogis had given. Therefore, it will not be possible for us to impute that prana pratishtha, that life into the idol, to the extent that it is required for us to sustain our belief that this idol itself is God. Whereas, in the temples, by an Agama Shastra, by a carefully orchestrated, oriented scheme of worship, a Mahakumbhabhishekam is performed, an Ashtabandhanam is provided to the Lord, And then there is a 24/7 ritual and performance which is being done day after day, month after month and year after year. Then you are able to experience divinity so easily when you go there than what you would get in the enviro in which you are present in your houses. And that is why in the stage in which we are, in the first stage, the temple provides a more conducive atmosphere to realize God Himself. Basavanna, the legendary poet from Karnataka, in his Basavanna Vakanna, which is legendary, that Lingayat, people have to read what he has written to believe how great he could have been. In chapter 820, Basavanna says, O Shiva, the rich can build temples for you. What is it that a poor man like me can do? He was a king himself, but he says, what is it a poor man like me can do? Then he says, my legs are the pillars, my torso the shine, my head the golden pinnacle. Things standing shall fall, the moving shall ever remain. This body itself is the temple. These two legs are the pillars of the temple. And here lies the shikaram, or the gopuram of that. And the garbhagrahastha is my heart, where the Lord resides. That is why we call him Narayanadayam. In the heart he remains. And therefore I do not look beyond myself. If I were to experience, if I come to that stage of believing in God, that here lies the God Himself. That you can create a temple within yourself. That extent of purity is required, the cleansing is required of the body and the soul to experience divinity. Having said this, of the basic elements of Hinduism, there are seven strong pillars at the contours over which the entire religion has been founded, strengthened and perpetuated over the years. And I call them the essential components of the religion because they bring out the greatness of this religion. The first is on truth. Ekam sat vipra bahudha vadanti. Truth is always one according to Hindu religion. It is only that the sages say it differently. They package it differently and convey it to you in the manner in which you want to understand that religion, that concept of truth. But truth is only one. So this is the first thought. I am not able to expand it today because of shortage of time. But this is the first thought, first element of Hinduism which is important. The second I have told you about, that there is divinity residing in each one of us. All that explanation I gave to you, that the Lord is here itself, is the second element of Hinduism. The third element of Hinduism is a corollary to this fact that there is divinity in me. Therefore there is divinity in you. And therefore there is no hatred between human beings. Love and tolerance comes as a function of this. That's the third one. And that's why I said the Ketha Upanishad. When I said Esti Sarvani Bhutani, that he who sees himself in others and sees others in himself, he does not hate anyone any longer. The fourth is, let noble thoughts come from all directions. The Rigveda says, let it come from all directions. That brings out the Catholicity of this religion. That brings out the tolerance of this religion that is capable of absorbing all the good elements from wherever it is in whichever part of the globe. The next thing that comes out, which according to me is the main pillar of this religion, is that this entire universe is one family. Vasudeva Kutumbakam. I am Nijaha Paro Vedi. Gananam Lagu Chetasam. Udhara Charitanam Tu. Vasudeva Kutumbakam. I am Nijaha. This is mine. That is yours. Is a thought that essentially comes into very small minds. But to the broad minded, the entire universe is one family. This is not a product of the liberalization that this world has seen, that the concept of a global village that has come. Several millennia before, it is the Hindu code which says that the entire world is one family. Because there is a European thought which says that it's a product of, the small global village is a product of liberalization that came down from there. Centuries before, this thought had come into this country. This is the strength of this religion, the one that believes that the entire world is one family. The path of salvation that is marked out in this religion is one of the most beautiful concepts ever to be given, and that Shankara gave. There is a misnomer that we say if we are attached to something, then we can never reach the path of salvation. Shankara says that you can never reach the purpose of your life unless you get attached. He says, Satsangatve Nissangatvam, Nissangatve Nirmohatvam, Nirmohatve Nischaratatvam, Nischaratatve Jivamukti. From attachment will come detachment, from detachment will come the equanimity of the mind, and from equanimity of the mind will come the liberation of the soul. Punarapi Jananam, Punarapi Maranam, that Shankara said in Bhajagovindam, the cycle of birth and death can stop when you only start with attachment. That means we should be attached to everything in life. Therefore, which religion can be more liberal than this religion which says, get attached to everything that you want. Because only if you experience it, that you will start then withdrawing from some of them, saying that these I don't need beyond this. So it all starts with attachment. There is a concept which is a very big concept which cannot be described in a situation like this. That is the part and the whole. The part is bigger than the part is part of the whole, and the whole is part of the part. Is something which is unique to this religion. Purnamadha, Purnamadam, Purnasya Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vishishte. That is one of the other components of this religion that brought strength to this religion over these several millennia and enabled it to survive over the test of time. Now, as I promised, I shall come to the last leg of my address on the sage of Kanchi himself. We should be grateful to God, for it was during our times that the sage of Kanchi tread this earth. To most of us who have seen him, worshipped him, experienced him, prostrated before him, he was a true Jivan Mukta, a liberalized soul, one who was far, far away from the bonds of this universe. And to most of us who have seen him, we had seen, as once Rudyard Kipling said, generations to come will scarce believe that such one as this in flesh and blood had walked in this earth. He said about Mahatma Gandhi, but to all of us who would have seen, was it ever possible for a saint to live the life that he led? He had no wants. When we were with Dr. Badrinath, he said in the shed, Vajradhan said, in my house shed, the Mahaswami held his puja and camp. All the cow dung sheds, all the mota sheds, all those exclusive areas where you and I will never go, became the abode of the sage of Kanchi. And all his lifetime, the sage practiced austerity, simplicity, and great lofty thoughts. It is very difficult for me to encapsulate before you the greatness of the saint in an address like this. But if I were to tell you, for the young people over here, that he was not an ordinary person, I can give you a few thoughts. He knew 17 languages. Almost all the Indian languages he could speak. And with ease he could speak. And he could speak enough of French, Hebrew, Spanish. And that will make you Russian. There are enough stories as to how Russians were floored by him when they came and started speaking something and they got the reply in Russian. For a person who had gone only up to the second form is equivalent of 6 years of age in school. He could speak virtually all the languages of this world. And therefore he could reach out to the hearts and minds of people because he could speak their mother tongue. And that does not come to ordinary persons. You and I are not endowed to even know those languages, even if you attempt to do that. I don't think this one lifetime is adequate for us to learn so many languages. But I shall bring out for you at least two instances in his life which bring out what this sage was all about. There is a practice in the matam all over the country, in the Hindu philosophy, that on the Mahashivaratri day, the Lord also fasts. Just as ordinary mortals and devotees fast on that day, the Lord also does not take any food. But the four kalas, the pujas which are being done from the evening till the next morning, all through the night, the prasadam is offered to the Lord. And immediately after it is being offered to him, it is put back out of circulation. In the Kanchi Mutt, there is a practice of digging an earth pit behind the puja mandapam. As soon as the kala is over, the prasada message is offered to Chandramaulishwara, is brought and dumped into the pit. The first kala, the second kala, the third, and the fourth is the Mahadeeparadana, the last kala where it is dumped, and then it is filled with mud and is offered to Mother Earth herself and to nobody else. On one such occasion, when the sage of Kanchi was performing the Mahashivaratri puja, the first kala food was dumped into the earth pit. And there was a para. Para means security guard, the man who will wait there to ensure that nobody touches it. There was a dog in the mutt which saw that food was dumped there. Naturally, its instinct was to go near it and eat. And all it got in return was a big stone with which it was hit. The dog cried. And the cry came within the visibility of listening of the sage of Kanchi who was performing his puja. Mahashivaratri is kashta maunam, therefore he cannot speak. He completed the four kalas, and early morning after the Deepardana was over, that day he gave a new dictum to the matam to say that the curd rice which is offered to the Lord at the last prophet, after the sambar rice is given to the Lord, the curd rice also is given. He said this should first be offered to the dogs of the mat. And from that day started a practice of offering this rice to the dog. And this was a very unique dog. The one that ate the prasadam of Chandramodishwara used to accompany the sage all during his yatras. The moment the cycle rickshaw used to start, exactly underneath the cycle rickshaw the dog will go. The pace at which the dog will move will be the same pace at which the cycle rickshaw will move. And once the rickshaw comes to a town and the sage goes into the town, the dog will vanish. Only to come back exactly at the time that the yatra commences again. And one such day, after I think it was 15 years, I don't know exactly, 14 or 15 years, the dog passed away. And that day the sage observed, Kashtam Avanam. Why I have said all this? Is that you and I believe that there is divinity in us. But the level to which he has reached, he says there is divinity in every being. Every creation of the earth has got divinity. And that he was able to espouse through this simple act, which became part of a religious dogma of not offering food to anyone, that it came to the privilege of the dog to take it. Not even on the day, on the Mahashivratri day as well. The second brings out his compassion. It was the year 1946. That was late in the evening. It was a Sunday evening. It was time for the sage to withdraw himself for his anushtanam. As he was about to retire and going for his bath and then start his anushtanam, a Muslim woman, I have said this from this platform, but to these young boys I wanted to say. A young woman, a Muslim woman, came crying before him. She was shouting at him. She told him, "You are a Jagadguru. This is all that you have taught to Hindu brethren. That they who have not created the human life are taking away life. If you are not the creator of that, how can you be the destroyer?" That she was shouting at him. For a moment the inner equilibrium of the Mahaswami was disturbed. And he went into silence. And then he felt, if I cannot do anything to address this wail of this poor Muslim woman who lost her husband in the partition war prior to independence, 1946, if you remember, there was a lot of Hindu-Muslim riots all over the country. And this poor lady lost her husband in Tamil Nadu thanks to that mindless aggression that took place between the Hindus and the Muslims. Then he thought to himself and said, if I cannot do anything to address the wail of this woman, the least I can do is to give up food on this Sunday evening. And for 46 long years, 48 long years, not 46, 1946 to 1994, for 48 long years, he abstained from food on the Sunday evening. For that soul that passed away for no fault of his, for the larger cause of Hindu-Muslim unity, for the cause of humanity. In fact, in all his addresses, the saint used to quote the Mahabharata, Panche Ahani Shasteva. If a day were to be divided into 8 parts, a Brahmin should eat only in the 5th or the 6th part. That is the Brahmin of those days, not the Brahmin of these days. Brahmin of these days eat in all the parts. Might be if you can create some more subdivided part, they can eat then also. In the 5th or the 6th part, the Brahmin is expected to eat a morsel of food. Morsel is only this much of food. Aparigraha, his non-possessiveness, is the greatest virtue of a Brahmin. That means he will not possess anything in life. And that's why he has to go through the suffering, because he is ordered to suffer and therefore deliver Ganesha to the hills of others. In one pretext or other, the sage also used to go through the same. He will spring in some new thought and say, today I am going to abstain from food because of this. That is the process of cleansing, as I said before, as to how it came. This is the greatness of the Jagadguru, whose birth anniversary we are celebrating today. My generation has let this country down. We have never realized our potential. We never believed that we could do it. That is why even today, the stark reality of poverty stares before us. 1 out of 3 Indians go for the night without food. The latest statistics says 32% is below the poverty line. I think we are more concerned with IPL than BPLs. I am also concerned with IPL. the stark reality of not having addressed the poverty of this nation, of having countless number of Indians going without food, not even a morsel of food. All that they can manage is one square meal, only one that comes to them, which is not enough to provide that energy that is required to sustain living. And still we all are living. But into the hands of all of you, the destiny of this nation can be written. The golden age of India can come through your hands. You can script a success story far different than the one that me or the generation before me have seen in this country. You can take this nation to its rightful place amongst the committee of nations. This is a great nation. It's a nation with a great history. Seldom can you get a nation with those many personalities, traits, and characteristics that this nation is endowed with. But then you should start believing in all of you that you can do it. As Socrates said, it's all in your hands. If you decide for yourself that the youth of this country can make it, and I should tell you, in a few years from now, we'll be the youngest nation. More than 53% of the total population will be less than 18 years of age. When all other nations in Europe and America have become geriatric, from a moment of geriatry, which our country was during independence, it is becoming younger and younger. And there is, by 2020, the figures will even come more than that. That you will have a large youth population, which would not have woken up every morning to the travails that I have seen, or my generation, the generation before me have seen of this country, of the politicians who have plundered this country, or the freedom that was given to us by our forefathers have been frittered away by us on wasteful things of life. You all, and the ones which are in the wombs and which have not been delivered, shall experience in India of a great land of opportunity, a land where the sun will really rise, and not the sun that I speak about. It is possible that this country can reach its heights thanks to all of you. May the Jagannath Koti Kamakshi shed her grace on all of us. May she enable us to achieve the purposes of her life. May the great Lord and may the Jagatguru and his worthy Sishyas shed their grace on us so that we can draw a leaf from the life of nobility of a great sage like him and make our own life sublime. Thank you and God bless you all.